From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I think the most important right now is we hear from the Senate hearings yesterday that Saudi Arabia is still not cooperating fully on terrorism. So they're still dragging their feet.
Ex-CIA agent Robert Baer talks about Saudi Arabia, 911, and how Washington sold our soul for Saudi crude. Then Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness is back from Iraq. The Treasury Department is trying to exact tens of thousands of dollars from the group. And we'll go to the International Black Panther Film Festival.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to August and Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Arms talks between the U.S., North Korea, and other countries near the Korean Peninsula may begin as soon as September in Beijing. North Korea is expected to put forward a proposal to end the nuclear standoff. North Korea yesterday announced it had dropped its demand for one-on-one negotiations with the U.S. Instead, six-way talks will take place between North and South Korea, Russia, China, Japan, and the United States. A Puerto Rican jury has acquitted two men accused of murder in one of the island's most controversial cases ever. The two men would have faced the death penalty if they'd been convicted, even though the island's constitution bars execution. The Ashcroft-led Justice Department overrode Puerto Rico's constitution, so federal prosecutors could seek the death penalty if the men were found guilty. Defense spending in the United States increased at the fastest rate in the past 50 years during the three-month period following the start of the invasion of Iraq. The Wall Street Journal reports the increase, the largest since the Korean War, was the main reason for the nation's gross domestic product jumping a robust 2.4% last quarter. The Pentagon is spending about $4 billion per month on the Iraq occupation, not including the costs of reconstructing the country. Meanwhile, the Financial Times reports that the oil services giant Halliburton's revenue jumped 11% last quarter, largely due to its work in Iraq. Halliburton's the company formerly headed by Vice President Dick Cheney. He still gets a regular check from them. But not all Americans are doing as well. A federal court ruled yesterday that IBM violated age discrimination laws in the way it changed its traditional pension plan in the 1990s. The decision could cast doubt over similar changes hundreds of companies have made in plans covering millions of workers, and IBM said it would appeal. Judge G. Patrick Murphy, a federal district court in the Southern District of Illinois, ruled IBM had discriminated against its older workers in several ways when it converted its pension plan because the changes would leave them with smaller benefit at retirement than younger workers would have when they eventually retire. In Iraq, two more U.S. soldiers have died in attacks. A Japanese journalist is reporting U.S. soldiers assaulted him and detained him after he took photographs of U.S. raids of homes in Baghdad that resulted in the deaths of Iraqi civilians. This according to the Japan Times. The reporter, 47-year-old Kazutaka Sato, was allegedly beaten, thrown to the ground by U.S. troops, had his hands tied, and was detained for an hour. The reporter said the U.S. soldiers may have been trying to hide the bodies of the civilians killed in the operation. The Washington Times reports the Bush administration is taking a new approach in dealing with the critics of the invasion of Iraq. Pentagon insiders are calling it a, quote, big impact plan. According to the Washington Times, the Pentagon plans to stop releasing information piecemeal about the failed hunt for weapons of mass destruction and wait for an extended period of time, maybe 6 months, to release a broader report. This news from Long Island, four teenagers have been arrested and charged with hate crimes for firebombing the home of a family of Mexican day laborers. The local district attorney said there was no question that they, quote, targeted this particular house because there were Mexicans living there. The teens are believed to have thrown live fireworks into the home just hours after much of the nation celebrated 4th of July. No one was injured in the blaze, which gutted the house. One of the teens' legal guardians told Newsday the boys were being treated unfairly. She said, quote, they're making an example of them because they don't know what to do with all those Mexicans over there. It was absolutely wrong what they did, but it was the 4th of July and it was a firework. It wasn't a Molotov cocktail or a firebomb. Day laborers in the Long Island community of Farmingdale have been targeted before. 2 years ago, two day laborers were severely beaten. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reports the national passenger train system Amtrak may largely cease to exist if Congress approves a new plan by the Bush administration to shift operating expenses of Amtrak from the federal government to individual states. The number of foreigners visiting the United States for education or medical reasons has dropped considerably over the past 2 years, this according to a report in the Christian Science Monitor. The numbers are expected to fall even more as the U.S. implements a new visa regulation that goes into effect today. From now on, each of the roughly 8 million people who apply for visas annually must be interviewed in person at a U.S. embassy, even if the nearest embassy is hundreds or thousands of miles away from where they live. The Monitor reports foreign attendance at U.S. English language summer classes is down about 30%. The world-famous Mayo Clinic has seen the number of international patients drop almost by a quarter since 2001. Visa applications have dropped by about 2 million since 2001. This news from Liberia. Talks have begun between West African foreign ministers and Liberian President Charles Taylor over his plans to resign and go into exile. This comes as an advance team of West African peacekeeping troops arrived in Monrovia. The full ECOWAS force of 1,500 is expected to arrive on Monday, and Taylor is expected to leave 3 days later. The Israeli parliament voted yesterday to stop allowing Palestinians from becoming Israeli citizens when they marry Arab Israelis. Opposition and Arab MPs charge the measure is racist and discriminatory. And finally, some 300 Palestinians and 60 international activists protested the so-called security wall outside Tulkarm in the West Bank today. Activists protested by cutting a section of wire in the fence before Israeli troops opened fire with rubber bullets, concussion grenades, and tear gas. We turn to Mohammed Boder, who is a Palestinian living in Tulkarm, but it looks like he just dropped off the line. We'll try to get to him later in the program.
على طول وذكريات كل اللي فات فاكرة يا بلدي قلبي مليان بحكايات فاكرة يا بلدي أول حب كان في بلدي مش موجود
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Welcome, Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners and viewers.
Well, we have Tulkarm on the line. Mohammed Boder is a Palestinian living there. Again, an action of about 350 people protesting the so-called security wall. Can you tell us what happened today, Mohammed Boder?
Yes. Hi, Amy. The people in this region, in Tulkarm region, arranged a demonstration just trying to have an access to their lands because the olive harvest is near. And there was a demonstration, and international groups from the ISM had been invited to this action, and we were there. And internationals and the local Palestinians got the riser fence, and they're trying to have an access to their land. And the soldiers, the Israeli soldiers, was waiting for the people there. And they start shooting rubber bullets and sand remains and tear gas. Five internationals injured by rubber bullets. And there was an injured, one of the internationals had been injured, has been hit in his neck by the rubber bullet. And there was also three local Palestinians have been injured in that action.
Mohammed Boder speaking to us from Tulkarm in the West Bank. More protests at what the Israeli military calls the security wall that's being built through the West Bank and what many Palestinians call the apartheid wall. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to the issue of the U.S. 911 and Saudi Arabia.
Yes, and the Financial Times today is reporting that the U.S. will send a team of senior FBI Treasury and State Department officials to Saudi Arabia and seek to press the kingdom for more action to prevent to cut off funds for terrorist organizations.
This is Muslim charities with close ties to the Saudi royal family were the main focus of a Senate hearing yesterday. The hearing exploded Saudi financing of terrorism. Sources told the New York Times that the charities were cited in classified sections of the nearly 900-page investigation of the September 11th attacks that were released by Congress last week. Large sections of the report explaining how the Saudis did not cooperate with U.S. intelligence agencies remain classified. An entire 28-page section detailing whether Saudi Arabia was somehow implicated in 911 is missing. President Bush says he will not release that information. The report did find that the Saudi government thwarted efforts to prevent the rise of al-Qaeda and stop attacks, as well as provide financial and logistical support to the Saudi-born September 11th hijackers. 15 of 19 of them were from Saudi Arabia. The New York Times reported yesterday that a prominent Saudi figure also mentioned in the report is Prince Nayef bin Abdel Aziz. Prince Nayef, who is a longtime overseer of Saudi's security forces, is Saudi Arabia's powerful interior minister and a brother of King Fahd.
A new book by former CIA agent Robert Baer claims that Nayef had twice sought to murder a leading Saudi dissident. In his book, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Its Soul for Saudi Crude, Baer alleges that Nayef's aborted political assassination of Mohammed al-Masari helped drive the Saudi dissident to extremism. The CIA is demanding that Baer remove the passages from the book that implicate Nayef, as well as another section claiming that other high-ranking members of the Saudi family were involved in the training of Chechen rebels with apparent ties to al-Qaeda. Robert Baer joins us on the phone today from Washington. Before we go to him, we're going to play a clip of President George Bush speaking at his ninth press conference at the White House 2 days ago. A reporter asked Bush about Saudi Arabia and the 911 report.
Mr. President, thank you. You met yesterday with the Saudi foreign minister who wants the administration to declassify these 27 or 28 pages about his government in this report on 9/11. Many members of Congress, including several Republicans, say they see nothing, or at least most of the materials in their view could be made public. Can you tell us, is there any compromise in sight on this? And could you at least summarize the material in that classified documents? Is there, as some members of Congress say, material that you could read and have an incriminating view of the Saudi government when it comes to 9/11?
John, the foreign minister did come and speak to me, and I told him this. I said, we have an ongoing investigation about what may or may not have taken place prior to September the 11th. And therefore, it is important for us to hold this information close so that those who are being investigated aren't alerted. I also told him in the document that if we were to reveal the content of the document, by the way, 29 pages of a near 900-page report, it would reveal sources and methods. By that I mean it would show people how we collect information and on whom we're collecting information, which in my judgment and in the judgment of senior law enforcement officials in my administration would be harmful on the war against terror. I just described to you that there is a threat to the United States. And I also said we're doing a better job of ensuring intelligence and collecting data so we're able to find it, you know, able to anticipate. And what we really don't want to do, it doesn't seem make sense to me, it doesn't seem like to me, is to reveal those sources and methods. Now, at some point in time, as we make progress on the investigation and as the threat to our national security diminishes, perhaps we can put out the document. But in my judgment, now is not the time to do so. And I made that clear to him, and I would be glad to making it clear to members of Congress. I want to remind you that, sure, some have spoken out, but others have agreed with my position, like the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. And so there's a different point of view. My point of view, however, since I'm in charge of fighting the war on terror, is that we won't reveal sources and methods that will compromise our efforts to succeed.
President Bush speaking at one of his rare news conferences this week in Washington, D.C. We turn now to Robert Baer. He's a former CIA agent, and he's written the book Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Your response to President Bush insisting on maintaining the 28-page gap?
You know, when it comes to national security, it's difficult to argue with the president. It's an argument you never win. But he's clearly confirmed that this information is related to Saudi Arabia, that Saudi Arabia obviously is not fully cooperating on terrorism, as we saw in the Senate hearings yesterday. But more than that, they are not telling us anything about the leads directly connected to the September 11 attacks. There are five or six Saudis who are apparently funding this attack, and the Saudis are not telling us what's their connection to the government or whether they're even connected to each other. And without their help, we're never going to get to the bottom of September 11th.
Who are these people?
We have a man in San Diego named Omar al-Bayoumi, who was apparently a Saudi agent, possibly working for the Ministry of Defense, who met the hijackers, put them in an apartment. He's provided inconsistent statements. He was funded by a member of the Saudi government, possibly somebody from the bin Laden family working for the government. The cells in Germany were Saudi businessmen were involved in funding them. In Hamburg, there was a man named Barakati. Darkan Zali, one of the key figures in the German cell, had a Saudi business partner. My question as a former agent is, you know, without a full, complete investigation, we don't know whether we're dealing with a conspiracy or individuals who, by coincidence, were associated with this attack.
And instead of a more complete investigation, what apparently, with your book, the CIA would like to create some more gaps in your reporting, in your own book.
I did get in a fight with the CIA. There were two issues, as you mentioned. One was the Nayef assassination. And the press was already on to this story. And I offered the CIA to tell them that I obtained this information after I left the CIA, not before. regarding the Chechens that occurred in 1998. Excuse me. It was a year after I left the CIA. They have no jurisdiction in censoring a book like that. And it was simply for political reasons to protect Saudi Arabia.
Well, could you explain for those of our viewers and listeners who are not familiar, under what regulations does the CIA, number one, demand that you change portions of your book? And then, two, a little bit more about the two cases that you mentioned, the Chechens and Nayef.
Sure. When you join the CIA, you sign a contract to submit anything you publish, either during your employment or after. And they are allowed to decide what information belongs to them and what is yours. And it's pretty one-sided process, although they can be very helpful at the same time. So when I left the CIA, I wrote my first book. I submitted it to them. They took out everything on Saudi Arabia, for instance, even though it was, I believe, was politically motivated. And on my second book on Saudi Arabia, they did the same thing. And a lot of the information I had in there, in fact, I did learn. Some they let in, some they didn't. So, and if they disagree with you and you publish in any case, they can take you to court, or they can seek criminal penalties, even, to the Department of Justice.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking to Robert Baer. His book is Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now! We're talking to Robert Baer. He's author of Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, an ex-CIA agent who's had his own book redacted by the CIA, a comprehensive book about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, in which he talks about, among other issues, does Washington have the capacity to see the Saudi kingdom for what it is? Or does it have its hands so deep in the Saudi wallet that it won't see and won't act? What about the Bush family relationship with the Saudi royal family? Write to Bush Sr. getting $1 million for his library from the Saudi royal family.
Well, it's more than that. They're closely connected with the investment firm, the Carlyle Group. The current president worked for the Carlyle Group when he worked for Qatar Air. A lot of their profits are made in Saudi Arabia off military sales, off military conversion. It's a program called the Offset Program. Many of the senior Republicans, that are advisors to this administration, James Baker, Frank Carlucci, Scowcroft, all have connections into Saudi Arabia, personal connections. They also have personal connections to the royal family. And combined with the fact that Saudi Arabia is so important for our economy, for stabilizing the price of world oil, using their surplus capacity, we're addicted, as I put it, or there's a very strong dependence on Saudi Arabia. which I think psychologically affects Washington's perceptions of that country.
Saudi Arabia has, in effect, become a post-employment compensation system for government officials, or especially on the Republican side?
Sure. You know, the Saudi ambassador has said in public that if I take care of people coming out of an administration, the new ones coming in are going to likely be much kinder to us. He's fairly blatant about it, and no one's blinked an eye. A lot of the defense contracts in this town are, in effect, subsidized by Saudi Arabia because they purchased so many American weapon systems, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas. The U.S. banks have up to $1 trillion, although that may be declining, of Saudi money. It's a very important relationship, and people are very reluctant in this town to break with Saudi Arabia or hold it accountable for funding charities, Islamic charities involved in terrorism, or directly funding terrorism.
Robert Baer, do you think Bush will be able to get away with, for example, the 28-page gap? I mean, among the most famous memories of Richard Nixon is the 18-minute gap. Why would he withhold this information, even with the Saudi foreign minister saying it should be released?
Well, you know, the Saudi foreign minister has asked for this to be released because that's a ploy of a public relations firm when you're in trouble. Always say, we want all the information out, we're innocent. I don't think the Saudis really want it out. And the problem I think that Bush is facing is if we look at the totality of the information related to 9/11, it's pretty clear that the Justice Department should be indicting Saudis. For instance, Zacharias Moussaoui, there's less evidence against him than there is against Omar al-Bayoumi or a couple of these people connected with the plot. So what's he going to do? I mean, if he indicts Saudis living in Saudi Arabia, the Interior Minister, Nayef, said he won't turn them over. He said that 2 days ago. And that puts him in a bind as well. So it's a thorny problem for the administration. I don't think they know how to get out of it.
Ambassador's wife.
In terms of the training of the Chechen rebels within Saudi Arabia and that are mentioned in your book, could you talk a little bit about that?
I came across a Russian report from their external intelligence agency, which described this training for Chechens. And they were training them in weapon systems, the Saudis, and sending them north to the Pankisi Valley in Georgia, where they were attacking Russian soldiers. This is what the Russians believe. We've chosen not to look into it. So I can't confirm it independently, but the Russians are very upset about this because they look at Saudi Arabia in a way as a U.S. surrogate, and they're wondering why we can't control Saudi Arabia and stop this.
Do you see any scenario where the U.S. would move in to so-called secure Saudi oil?
Well, you know, it's an alarmist statement to say we need to secure it. But yesterday, the head of FBI counterterrorism acknowledged that it's a question of survival in Saudi Arabia. And can we stand by and watch the fundamentalists take the oil facilities and remove 10 million barrels of oil a day? That's their capacity, which would profoundly affect the economy. We'd end up paying, you know, $5 or $6 for a gallon of gasoline if that occurred, or if their problems spilled over. You know, this is the perfect storm of politics, Saudi Arabia going under. We're not there yet, but I could foresee a day that things get worse, like chaos in Iraq spilling over into Saudi Arabia, where we might have to send it just to secure the oil fields, not occupy Saudi Arabia. It's too difficult. So to answer your question, I foresee that.
You've also said that Saudi Arabia provides a 401k plan for many former U.S. officials.
It does. I've had a lot of colleagues that worked in the Near East Division, the CIA. They went directly to work. And I didn't name them in the book, by the way. I didn't want this to, you know, be a gossipy book, but they worked for the Saudi Embassy, National Security Council. It's normal for somebody handling the Near East to go work for a Saudi consulting firm. These people are fairly well known in Washington. I'll let the newspapers describe it if they want to.
Finally, you say Saudi Arabia itself has not been involved with fighting for many, many years. And yet, where does the vast amount of money for its defense budget go?
It goes into pockets. You know, that they spend 13% of their gross domestic product on arms, 50% of their revenues. They don't have an army that can fight. In the first Gulf War, they couldn't use their tanks because they hadn't bought filters. And they didn't buy filters because you can't get bribes from the sale. The Saudi Arabia is corrupt by anybody's standards. And it's unfortunate because what we want is young Saudi men to be working, to be employed, to have industries, to have universities that teach information technology. Instead, they're going to the mosque and they're unemployed.
Finally, the Vanel Corporation, recently a target in Saudi Arabia that no one talks about in the government very much. They simply say something like 9 Americans died, but what Vanel Corporation is doing in Saudi Arabia and what it is?
It's a mercenary army training the Saudi National Guard, for instance. It used to belong to the Carlyle Group. It has close connections with the administration. And the presence of American contractors or troops is a target for the Saudis. Bin Laden is very popular in that country on the street. And, you know, I'd like to add one other thing, is the Saudis say that we are victims of terrorism, but in fact there has been no assassination, for instance, of Saudi royal family members. It's always been directed against the West.
Well, Robert Barry, I want to thank you very much for being with us. His book is Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Robert Baer is a former CIA agent. Parts of the book are redacted. You are listening to Democracy Now!
And now we go on to the Treasury Department notified the humanitarian group Voices in the Wilderness yesterday that they have 10 or 20 days to pay tens of thousands of dollars in fines for violating sanctions against Iraq. Since its founding in 1996, Voices in the Wilderness has campaigned to end economic and military warfare against the Iraqi people. They have done this mostly by organizing delegations to Iraq in deliberate violation of U.N. economic sanctions and U.S. law to publicly deliver small amounts of medical supplies to children and families in need. Many of the group's members refuse to pay taxes for war. And we're joined now by Kathy Kelly, who has been a frequent guest on the show, to talk about what's gone on.
So were you surprised to receive this notice from the Treasury Department saying they're demanding tens of thousands of dollars from your group?
Well, in a way, we were surprised that coming closer to an election campaign for Mr. Bush, that he might awaken an extra problem for them, because I really do think that if they come after us, were they to place a seizure on the bank account or seize assets or put a padlock on our office, which is also my home, I think we would actually find that many people would start to ask some questions. Did we act criminally in bringing medicine to children and some toys? Or was it criminal for the United States to engage in the most recent warfare that continues, and also with Mr. Bush clearly intending to extend his war, so-called war against terrorism, against millions of people in other parts of the world? We see it as an opportunity to continue the much-needed education.
Can you explain exactly what you did? What is the law they say that you broke?
Well, the law that was in place and has now been lifted said that American people could not go to Iraq at all. Just showing up in the country was a violation of the law, and any transaction whatsoever was a second violation. And we did both, and we very publicly acknowledged and claimed our right to travel and to practice what we would call the works of mercy. So the actual line says for bringing medicine and toys to Iraq, we've been accused of a crime.
So what will you do now? You have how many days to respond?
Well, we were given 20 days to respond, and we received a summons 2 days ago. We'll do as we've done in the past. We'll try to create the most eloquently rhetorical statement about why we've done what we've done. I'll leave to go to Iraq again in mid-August with two people who were also part of the Iraq peace team. We'll continue our presence in Iraq, and I think we would easily find 20,000 people who would each contribute $1 toward collecting money that would again go to meet the cares and concerns of ordinary Iraqis with whom we want to stand in solidarity, but not to pay these penalties. You know, on day three of the bombing that happened under shock and awe, $1 billion was spent just on that one day for the bombs that exploded over children and families in Iraq. I think that's the crime.
What's in the situation in Iraq now? When was the last time that you were there?
I left on April 19th, and as we hear from people over there, it seems as though there's a great deal of concern about how free people actually are to speak their mind. You know, we thought there would be a relief with Saddam Hussein gone, but, you know, on July 22nd, the New York Times reported that the United States government is actually rehabilitating former members of the Secret Service, the Mukhabarat, and particularly seizing on those that could give them information about Iran or about relations between people in Iraq and Iran. Now, that's going to create a lot of anxiety all over again, that the Secret Service in Iraq that would turn people in before for torture or possible execution has not disappeared.
And how did this? How has the support for Voices in the Wilderness grown in recent years as you've been conducting this battle against sanctions?
Well, every time the United States government has confronted us, our support has just about tripled or quadrupled. So again, we see this as an opportunity for outreach and education.
Well, Kathy Kelly, we want to thank you for being with us in New York for Pax Christi Conference, twice nominated herself for a Nobel Peace Prize. She is the co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness that's based in Chicago. We'll certainly continue to follow that case. When we come back, an interview with Kathleen Cleaver, former Black Panther. Stay with us. That's James Brown, Funky President, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Earlier this week, I had a chance to talk to Kathleen Cleaver about the International Black Film Festival, Black Panther Film Festival, that opened last night in New York. It was founded by Kathleen Cleaver, one of the major voices of the Black liberation movements of the 60s and 70s. She joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1966. Later, she joined the Black Panther Party, became communications secretary of the party, was the first woman in the party's central committee. In the early 70s, she spent years in exile with her then-husband Eldridge Cleaver in Algeria. She returned to the U.S., went on to Yale Law School, now teaches at Yale and Emory. I started by asking her about her inspiration for the festival.
The inspiration is sort of serendipitous in that when Eldridge Cleaver died, the year later we held, Jamal Joseph and I organized a memorial concert here in New York. And we had all kinds of musicians like Max Roach and Nile Rodgers, hip-hop, gospel. And we tried at the end of the concert, which had 900 people, it was a free concert, to take up a collection to give money to political prisoners. And we didn't really get very much money, not even enough to cover our equipment rental. And I said to Jamal, a memorial is not the place to collect money. It's sort of like a healing and a remembrance. But if we want to have money, what we should do is do something we can sell tickets. We should do a film festival. He said, right. So we decided, yeah, there was over 20 films out there. I had worked on many of them. He and I had worked on one together about the Black Panthers or the Young Lords or those activist days. I knew of many because I'd been communications secretary and had seen many of these films, and people came to me to ask me to help them with their films. So we pulled together, I think, a day and a half of films, held them at the Schomburg, showed them at the Schomburg, and it was a big hit. It was like sold out, and people loved it. And I said, well, we've got to do this again and do it right. So the following year, we did a four-day festival at Columbia and at the Schomburg with, you know, panels and films, and it was well-funded. It was, you know, over 2,000 people came. And so then I decided we'd do another one, but we'd take 2 years to build up and get the money and get the films, and people look forward to it. This year it's a little more complicated, a little less well-funded than the one before, but it's an extraordinarily engaging and lively event.
Talk about some of the films in the film festival. Everything from Weather Underground to the film
John Henrik Clark, A Great and Mighty Walk, director Gloria Rolando's film, Eyes of the Rainbow.
Well, Eyes of the Rainbow is an extraordinary film that's almost impossible to see. It's not in theaters. It's not on television. It was shot by Gloria Rolando in Cuba of Assata Shakur. She and Assata worked on this together. But because it was made in Cuba, as the director explained, she didn't have access to the stock footage. She didn't have access to certain kind of techniques. So it's not one of these documentaries where you get to see a lot of what happened in the past. She uses dance, Afro-Cuban song, interesting sets, like it opens in a dungeon and then it moves to an old plantation. She has to use very artistic means to convey the story, and it's a very captivating interview with Assata that is shot in color. Very beautiful film.
I had the unusual experience a few years ago of going to Havana over New Year's and seeing that film with Assata Shakur there in just a small, dark, bar-like place, and then she spoke about it afterwards.
Wow. That's amazing. So we show it regularly because one of the directors of our festival has a copy of the film. There's only three in existence in the United States. We show films that talk about that era, that struggle, films that talk about other movements. For example, in the John Henrik Clark film, it's really an Afrocentric look at history on the part of Dr. Clark and a look at his life. And it's sort of a very broad scope from the 25th dynasty in Egypt to the Million Man March. So that gives us sort of a context.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
We're also showing the documentary Passing It On, which is about the prisoner, Daruba bin Wahad, was a Black Panther who was held for 19 years in prison on charges of attempted murder that he didn't commit. And he finally was able to prove it and get out. And this film, this documentary was made upon his release, and it goes back over his life and his imprisonment and his involvement in the Panthers. And it ends with a big rally in Harlem when Nelson Mandela came to Harlem. So that's a upbeat film.
I came to give you an address from the political prisoners held captive in the dungeons of the United States. They do not want me to give you this address because they do not want our South African brothers to know that there are Black political prisoners here in the United States. Brother, comrade Nelson Mandela, on behalf of my brothers in prison, on behalf of the Puerto Rican Nationalistas, on behalf of the Native American political prisoners, and on behalf of the white American political prisoners, I say to you, brother, we love you, and we will not give up the fight. 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 Amanla! Amanla!
We're showing some new films, like Next Question, the May Day 1970 Project, which is a film about 12 high school students in New Haven who studied, did an oral history study of what happened back in 1970 when there was this huge, huge, massive demonstration on May Day 1970 in front of the courthouse against the Panther trials. You know, who were the Panthers? Why did that come? They interviewed the chief of police, they interviewed activists, they interviewed Panthers, and a documentary was made about them studying it. So we're showing the film. The director will be there, and some of the students who are now in college will be there to talk. We're showing Estilo Hip Hop, which is a trailer of film in progress that goes to Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Puerto Rico, and Cuba, looking at the youth activism in the context of hip-hop and how they express themselves and how they identify with hip-hop here. We're showing a concert film about Gil Scott-Heron done by Robert Muggy, showing sort of the roots of rap and the consciousness that Gil Scott-Heron was very instrumental in developing. The film was shot in the 80s. So we cover the cultural, the political, and a broad range of films.
You know, this is a national program, and not everyone is going to get to go to this film festival, which will be taking place this weekend at City College and at Columbia as well. But it's very interesting to hear how you've put this together. It is something people can do in many places around the country. And since people are so affected by films, especially young people, I'm wondering how it is for you, a former Black Panther. You're going to be teaching a course in women in the Black Freedom Movement at Yale this fall, to now look at these films so much that document what you were involved with for decades and how you think that's being conveyed today in this time of the so-called war on terror.
Well, actually, it's usually not being conveyed. If we didn't have our festival out there, people wouldn't get to see these films. So many young people come and say, well, I've never heard of this. They don't tell us about this in school. The mass media culture that engulfs most people leaves out radicals, leaves out Black Panthers, leaves out anti-war people. So what we're doing is filling in gaps in a very small way. However, it's catching on. I was out at the University of California, the Berkeley Art Museum. They did a mini, you know, film festival in connection with an exhibit that they were showing, and they went to our website and found out our films and used some of them. And the same thing's happening at the UCLA Hammer Center in November. They go to our website and look at films.
So what is your website?
Our website is www.pantherfilmfest.com. And we try to put on there descriptions of the films, how to get the distributors, other information about past festivals. So it's a more comprehensive website. One thing I'd like to say is that we're all volunteers. Everything is done by volunteers. Our website is hosted and designed by volunteers. So it's an extraordinarily energetic festival.
When and why did you become a Black Panther?
Oh, gosh. I was in the civil rights movement in 1967, I was in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, but I had wanted to be in the movement and had basically been doing things since I was in high school. I'm from Alabama, where the protest movement and the Montgomery bus boycott started. In my hometown, we had boycotts. It was like 45 miles away from Montgomery. So to be in the movement and to be part of the struggle against racism and segregation was the thing to do. I was in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, organized a conference, was part of the organizers of a conference of a Black student conference at Fisk, and I met Eldridge Cleaver, who came as a speaker. He and I fell in love. I moved out to California to work with the Panthers, sort of because the only way we could be together was for me to leave Atlanta and go to California. He was on parole, and by the time I got there, Huey Newton, who was the leader of the Black Panther Party at that time, had been shot, been arrested, charged with murdering a policeman. The party was in crisis. It had lost its office, lost its newspaper, and so I started organizing a defense fund, organizing demonstrations. It sort of like kind of fell into that aspect of the same movement I'd been a part of in Atlanta. It was at the era of Black Power. So it wasn't really so much about organizational as geography. Here, this is the California version of Black Power. So,
and then what happened? How did you end up leaving the United States?
Well, 2 days after Martin Luther King's assassination in Memphis, there was a conflict, a shooting between the Oakland police and the Black Panthers, and Eldridge Cleaver was one of those people involved. He was wounded, he was arrested, he was charged with 3 counts of attempted murder. Since he was on parole, he was immediately imprisoned, but he actually was released on a habeas petition in June of 1968, and when he was ordered to return to prison, he didn't. He left the country. He went to Cuba, and by the time I left the country in May, we met in Algeria. And in Algeria, we set up the international section of the Black Panther Party until there was a division that sort of destroyed the unity that this huge national and international organization had maintained over a period of years. And we were all expelled and eventually came back to the United States and went back to school and... So now I organize the film festival.
And what role do you think the government and COINTELPRO counterintelligence program played in all of that?
The government was on the case all along. One of the things they said they wanted to make sure didn't happen was that they call them the militants, the Black militants in the United States, should not make contact with the Arabs and African liberation movements, which is exactly what we went to Algiers and did. They also were very anxious to destroy the unity within the movements. They were anxious to prevent young people from joining these movements, from prevent the larger community from respecting the movements, prevent any leader from becoming what they called a black messiah. So this was the basic tenets of counterintelligence. And out of all the organizations that they targeted, the Black Panther Party, according to the Church Committee report that was released after the hearings in the, Select Senate Committee on Governmental Activities with Regard to Intelligence, short committee, I think it was 285 actions of the FBI's COINTELPRO were targeted against the Black Panther Party. Now, that doesn't include the Department of Defense Intelligence, the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency. They also had counterintelligence programs targeting us, or any of the individual police departments. So we were really in the crosshairs of a lot of activity that was aimed to destroy our movement and destroy our organization. The organization, in fact, was destroyed. Many of the people, however, survived.
One of the films you're showing is the Weather Underground film, and in it, it talks about the white militants who went underground, like Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers and Mark Rudd, and the Black Panthers, people like Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, and how the black militants, many were killed. They were killed in 69 by the Chicago police. The white militants went underground, were very inspired and angered by what had taken place, and that was part of their what caused them to do what they did.
The Weathermen took their name from the Bob Dylan lyric, "You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows," by which they meant anyone could see world revolution was imminent. Third world revolutionaries and militant groups in America, like the Black Panthers, would soon overthrow the American government. They argued that SDS had to join this worldwide revolution by organizing white kids to begin fighting.
White youth must choose sides now. We must either fight on the side of the oppressed or be on the side of the oppressor.
The Black Panther Party was viewed by the people who went into the Weather Underground, among others, as what they call the revolutionary vanguard, that this was what the leadership, and this was where the most intense revolutionary activity was taking place, and this was where the most intense retaliation was being felt, and that they wanted to respond in some way to the way in which the attacks against the Panthers, these devastating, murderous attacks, so they would set off bombs in response. It's very interesting that of all the COINTELPRO activity of the FBI and everything they did to the Panthers, the only time the government brought charges against any FBI agent were because of an invasion into a home of some of the Weather people parents. And they were charged and they were convicted and then pardoned by Ronald Reagan.
So at the time of the Weather Underground, the film documenting that, that you're going to be showing at the film festival, what were you thinking of them, and where were you at that point?
I believe I was in North Africa. I believe I was in Algiers at the time of most of the actions in the Weather Underground film. And in fact, some of the people who we knew in the Weather Underground were involved in breaking out Timothy Leary from prison, which I believe is shown in the film. And they spirited him out of the country and brought him to the international section of the Black Panther Party in Algiers. Actually, at that time, I remember now, I was in North Korea. My daughter was born in North Korea because I remember coming back in September to my home and meeting Timothy Leary standing up in my living room. You know, so
what were you doing in North Korea?
That's what the press wanted. They say allegedly I had a baby. I had a baby. My husband, Eldridge Cleaver, and Bob Scheer had taken a delegation. It was called the American People's Anti-Imperialist Delegation. And they'd taken a delegation to visit North Korea, and the time of the visit coincided with the time at which I was supposed to give birth. And we were very close in Algiers with the representatives of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, commonly called North Korea. And so I was invited, actually, not to be part of the delegation, but I was invited by the Democratic Women's Union to have a baby so I could be there at the same time as the delegation, so I wouldn't be left alone on my own in Algiers.
So what was that experience like, and what do you think about what's happening with North Korea today?
Well, I understand why they call it the Far East. I mean, it's really, really far. But I sort of felt it was like communist Switzerland. It was very, very remote and very well organized at that time. What's happening now is so far different in the sense of the collapse of the socialist economy around the world. And Korea, which had a very powerful economy at that time, but it was plugged into other countries, was plugged into the Soviet Union predominantly. So their economy is in a state of total collapse. And the seems to be, from what I can tell, highly repressive. And the opening, there's been a tremendous opening towards the people in the North by the government of South Korea. So there's a sense that there is somewhere to go.
Finally, Kathleen Cleaver, now doing this film festival in this period of time, in the Bush era, what do you tell your students or people who come to the films about how this period compares to the activism of 30 and 20 years ago?
Well, one of the things we talk about is the similarity of the repressive measures, such as the USA Patriot Act, and the type of things the government is enabling itself to do openly that they did covertly against us, such as spying and arresting people for political reasons and invading their homes and opening their mail and tapping their phone and all those type of things that they did to us but they said they didn't do. Now it's like out in the open. But the other thing is that the passion and the commitment and the devotion that so many young people felt at that time to bring about change, to end racism, to end war, is something that this generation is not familiar with. They don't see that. They don't have that sense in a large collective sense. They have it in sort of little individual pockets. And I think what we would like to convey is that it is possible. It is possible to envision a different world. It is possible to band together. It is possible to bring about social change, although it's more difficult because at the time that we were trying to bring about radical alterations, it wasn't as if we were the only ones. The entire society, including the government, recognized that there was something wrong, that there had to be change. The issue was who was going to make it and how fast it was going to be, not whether there would be change. Whereas now we have these reactionary wackos that want to return the society to like a pre-1960 racist, capitalist, you know, like almost like a 19th century world. It's like old time imperialists. Let's go and invade other people's countries. You know, let's get rid of public schools. It's an extraordinarily reactionary time. And so for them, the task is harder. But the first task is to band together and find other people and to begin to organize and begin to develop a mass movement, which we see starting in the anti-globalization movement. And of course, the war on terrorism is undermining all of this. But it's really a war on people.
Former Black Panther Kathleen Cleaver, executive producer of the International Black Film Festival, Black Panther Film Festival, that's taking place at City College in New York this weekend. That does it for the program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kadous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, Anna Noguera, as well as Lenina Nadal. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.